The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I talked about equanimity, and I'd like to continue that discussion. Last week I was talking about the practice of equanimity and how we can cultivate the quality of equanimity by noticing when we're not equanimous, noticing when we're reactive, that actually is a pathway towards cultivating equanimity, that when we notice the reactivity, we can observe it, and in that observation, we're cultivating mindfulness, which begins to bring along with it the quality of balance of mind. Even if in the observation we feel like we're not completely at ease around what's happening, just the beginning of turning towards our experience instead of automatically reacting in the ways that we normally react begins to cultivate this quality of balance of mind. And one of the ways, so this is just a little brief review, one of the ways that this seems to work is that as we turn towards our experience, we notice, we can begin to notice that we're not exactly at ease around what's happening. So for instance, say you're paying attention to a pain in the body, some physical pain, and you're paying attention to that pain, and if you, in paying attention to that pain, begin to notice there's a not liking of that pain. I don't like that. I want it to go away. Then that's and that's a reactivity to the pain. So that's the place where the mind is not balanced or at ease around the experience. And so what we then do is turn our attention to that not liking. Rather than trying to force ourselves to stay with the thing that we don't like, we turn the attention to the not liking itself. And I found, at least for myself, when I actually acknowledge what's actually going on, oh, I don't like this, there's a way that the mind can begin to relax around that. And so we can be at ease around our dislike. We can be kind of at ease around our reactivity. And we keep going with this process from noticing the not liking. We might notice a sense of frustration about the not liking. Just noticing that. And that in this way, continuing to notice our relationship to experience, kind of backing up. I do this motion all the time, back up to see how we're looking at experience. In that practice, we begin to uncover kind of hidden reactivity through that practice. And bringing the hidden reactivity into our mindfulness practice begins to allow it to be understood, be known, and it does tend to allow it to dissipate. Essentially, because we come into some kind of balance around our reactivity, that begins to support the mind settling in general. So this practice of turning to what's difficult for us, noticing how we're not equanimous, begins to cultivate equanimity. Today I'd like to talk a little bit more about the kind of more the qualities that begin to support equanimity. I think I said last week that equanimity itself is a result of our practice. It's kind of comes along with the meditation practice. It comes along with the mindfulness practice. It's not so much something we do as something that begins to happen. There are ways to directly point the mind at equanimity, but in most cases, the quality of equanimity is a result rather than the thing that we do. So I'd like to talk about some of the conditions and things that we can do that will support equanimity. And the first two go together, but I'll talk about them a little bit separately. And they are mindfulness and concentration. Those two qualities of mind, that we have some ability to connect with as an active practice. We can connect with concentration, we can connect with our experience, connect with our breathing, and begin to settle the mind. So concentration practice, in general, it's generally described by a settling of the mind on a single experience, like the breathing. We could also have it be on hearing, or the phrases of metta are also a concentration practice. Creating an image in the mind, those kinds of things, they're concentration practices. But in general, what we do with concentration is we stabilize the mind on a single experience. And just keep coming back to that over and over again. Whenever we notice that the mind has wandered off, we come back to that single thing. So what this begins to do for us is, well, a couple of things. One is that the practice of coming back, of letting go of anything not the object of meditation, I'll just talk about it as the breath, letting go of anything not the breath, begins to settle down the five qualities that get in the way of being able to settle down, which are the five hindrances. So the five hindrances being sense, desire, anger or aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, essentially sleepiness, and doubt. And the concentration directly opposes those qualities of mind. There are factors of the mind that come into play in concentration that directly actually suppress those hindrances. So it is a suppression in concentration. It's a suppressing of those hindrances. So as the mind settles down, just through this simple act of letting go of anything not the breath and coming back, the mind begins to settle down and lets go of the reactivity. Let's go of sense desire. Let's go of aversion. Let's go of sleepiness. Let's go of restlessness. And let's go of doubt. And that's a whole Dharma talk in and of itself, and I won't go into that so much at the moment. So as the mind begins to settle down with concentration, because these hindrances dissipate, we actually get a taste of what it feels like to be without these hindrances. We get a taste of the mind that is more at ease. And this is the beginning of the flavor of equanimity that is cultivated through concentration. Now, it's a constructed kind of equanimity here. It's a concentration is a constructed mental state that has come about through this practice of bringing back, coming back over and over again to the breath. So the concentration can be shattered when conditions change. And the equanimity that comes along with it will also go when those conditions change. But it begins to give you a flavor of what it means to not be reactive. You're sitting in meditation and perhaps the sound of the garbage truck comes by, and perhaps initially you're reactive to that. You don't like it, you're frustrated by it, you feel like it's keeping you away from the meditation. But you just keep coming back over and over again, and over time it begins to recede. The sound begins to recede, and you're just able to stay with the breath. And you begin to actually see that it's not so much the sound that's the problem as it is the mind's reactivity. That's the thing that's disturbing. So the mind that begins to get concentrated begins to understand what it means to not be reactive. And that's a kind of a basic definition of equanimity, a non-reactive mind, a mind that's balanced, not one that's not connected. The equanimous mind is actually connected to experience. So this is a place where you can kind of see that with concentration, the equanimity is a little more, it's more fragile in a way. It's not the equanimity of whatever is arising, because the mind in the space of concentration has just kind of come into one experience. So it's basically not picking up on other experiences. So it's not so much not reacting to the sound of the garbage truck because it hears the garbage truck. It's more, it's not really connecting to that sound of the garbage truck, so it's not reacting to it. So that's the way that the non-reactivity, the flavor of non-reactivity comes with the concentration practice. It's more of the mind is kind of gathered on one thing and everything else has just receded. So there is much less to react to in the state of concentration. But at the same time, you get a sense of that mind that is non-reactive. So it's a flavor, it's a taste of that quality of equanimity. And then mindfulness. Mindfulness cultivates equanimity also through meeting experience directly and just being able to meet experience as it is. Now, that's a tall order. I mean, it is a tall order to simply meet experience as it is. But as you cultivate this willingness to meet experience, as you cultivate the quality of mindfulness itself, equanimity naturally comes along for the ride. Now, initially, when we're bringing mindfulness to something like the sound of the garbage truck, for instance, you know, if you're actually in mindfulness practice, we don't so much necessarily focus on one thing. Although we can, in mindfulness practice, turn our attention to the breathing and just focus on the quality of change within the breathing. But often in mindfulness practice, we actually open to a larger range of experience. We open to sound, we open to body sensations, we open to moods, emotions. We're just kind of in the flow of the full experience of life. And often in our practice of that, we see the reactivity. And so that goes back to the conversation from last week. We cultivate the mindfulness on our reactivity. Now, the understanding, and this is a pretty technical understanding, but the understanding in Buddhist psychology is that in a moment of mindfulness, there is also equanimity. And there is also non-greed and non-aversion. So in a split second of the mind actually connecting with experience, the Buddhist psychological understanding is that in that split second, greed, aversion are not present, and balance of mind is present. Essentially, balance of mind being, you know, the absence in a way of greed and aversion, but it's talked about as being its own quality. So in that moment, equanimity is being cultivated in just bringing mindfulness to experience. Now, in the next split second, there may be reactivity to what we've just experienced. And then we're reactive. And in the next moment, perhaps we can be mindful of that reaction. So the Buddhist psychology view of the mind is that there are these individual discrete moments of experience. And when mindfulness is present, the mind is in a very wholesome state. It's got non-greed, non-aversion. It's got balance of mind. It's got mindfulness. And so this sense that we have that we can be mindful of reactivity is the fact, it is because of the fact that these mind moments that the Buddhist psychology talks about are so brief. these mind moments are, I think there's like millions or billions of mind moments in the blink of an eye. So in the space of a blink of an eye, the mind can move between mindfulness and reactivity very quickly. And so the feeling that we have around mindfulness becoming more predominant for us has to do with kind of the how many of those mind moments have mindfulness in them. So that's the feeling, is how much it feels like we can be mindful has to do with how many of those moments there are. So it sounds like there's a little bit of a contradiction when we say that a mind moment of mindfulness doesn't have greed or aversion. Well, then how can we be mindful of greed and aversion? It's because of this rapid alternation that the mind can pay attention to these difficult states of mind. So the cultivation of mindfulness itself brings along equanimity for the ride, which is a great thing. It's a great thing for us that it has this quality. And I think this is one of the reasons why the Buddha really pointed to this quality, that mindfulness, out of all of the things in a moment of mindfulness, there's the mindfulness that comes along, there's non-greed, non-aversion, there's the balance of mind. Of all of those qualities in a moment of mindfulness, the easiest thing to connect to in terms of practicing is the mindfulness. Much easier to connect with mindfulness than it is to connect with, I'm not going to be greedy right now, or I'm not going to be averse right now, or I'm going to be completely balanced right now. We don't seem to be able to do that. But we do seem to be able to connect with being aware, being mindful. So I think I don't know actually if it's true, this description of the mind that it arises in just this split second, and in that split second, mindfulness is not present with aversion, because I can't see those individual mind moments. I've seen things happen pretty rapidly, but I haven't seen those individual mind moments. But in any case, I know for myself that mindfulness in my practice has been extremely powerful, and I've seen that the more mindful I am, the more mindfulness that is present for me, the less reactive the mind is. And even as the mindfulness is able to take in something difficult like anger or a strong sense of wanting, as the mindfulness can take that in, there's a little bit of space around those things as well. So there's less reactivity to the anger, to the wanting. So in my own experience, I've clearly seen mindfulness be directly related with this balance of mind, with this equanimity. So it's a great practice for us. As we cultivate the mindfulness, if you practice a kind of a continuous mindfulness practice, and the noting practice is one of the practices that supports a kind of continuity of mindfulness. And I'm not sure all of you have heard about the noting practice, so I'll just describe it a little bit. The noting practice is a practice of using a very quiet mental label in the mind that connects with whatever we are predominantly experiencing. And this, we can do this in a, just right now, for instance, you can just do this. What are you predominantly aware of in this moment? Pressure of your butt, feeling of your hands, feeling of your feet, perhaps the sound. And what you can do is to just kind of connect with what it is that's predominant for you with a soft mental note. And I'll model this for you out loud right now. Pressure, vibration, seeing, tension, seeing, hearing, vibration, calm, tension, contraction, hearing, happiness, quiet, vibration. Just keeping a very steady naming of experience going brings a continuity of mindfulness that even if there is a little bit of reactivity that comes up, it's like, you know, hearing, aversion, and then pressure, and then vibration. And there's not much time for you to kind of proliferate on reactivity when you're just continuing with this just very steady noticing of what's happening moment to moment. And using this labeling is another tool that helps to kind of break into that thread of proliferation. Because so much of our reactivity comes out of thought. We hear the sound of the garbage truck, and why don't they change their schedule? You know, they shouldn't be doing this in the morning when there's meditation going on. I mean, don't they know there's meditation going on this corner? So the, you know, the mind moves into proliferation and thinking, which tends to feed the reactivity. And if you're just noting and noticing, hearing, aversion, hearing, vibration, pressure, there's not as much time. The kind of part of the mind that would be making all those stories is occupied with this naming process. So that's a very great tool to support mindfulness, which in turn supports equanimity. And you can directly see this in your practice by using this very gentle, soft naming. Now, it's really, there's an art to this noting, this naming tool. It's really easy to get over-vigorous with the naming and not keeping it such a light, soft whisper in the mind. And it's also easy to move away from the experience more to the idea of the experience with the naming. So instead of actually being with the hearing, you're with the thought, oh, I'm hearing now. You know, it's like there's more of the idea of hearing than the actual experience of hearing. So that's something you need to kind of learn to navigate. It's kind of like learning to ride a bicycle. You know, you kind of, it's a little wobbly at first. It feels a little bit awkward. It's hard to see necessarily how to connect with experience while you're using this labeling part of your mind. So it takes some practice. One helpful way, I mean, the way I like to use the naming, the noting practice, is as a receptive kind of thing. So that we're not trying to decide what to pay attention to and then naming that. We could do that. I mean, we could direct the attention somewhere and say, okay, now I'm going to pay attention to seeing. Okay, seeing is happening right now. Now I'm going to pay attention to the body. Okay, body sensations. I feel the tightness. I feel the pressure. So you can do that. But the way I think it's helpful to engage with this is more to be receptive. Can you just receive experience and notice what it is that the mind is naturally attending to? So that you're not trying to find what is happening. You're just noticing what's naturally already happening. One of the amazing things about this mind is that it naturally attends to things. We don't have to get involved with choosing what to attend to. It will pay attention to something. So can you notice what it is that the mind is naturally paying attention to? And then just use that, name that. This can help keep it a little bit lighter, so that it doesn't feel so much like you're forcing the mind to pay any attention to anything. It's much more laid back, sitting back, and receiving that experience. So I'm going to stop here and just see if there's any comments or questions. I have more to say about cultivating. Yeah, Diana.
Thank you. So this is a technical question, and I'm kind of glad you brought this up about noting, because it's something I've been thinking about. So let's use the example of the garbage truck. Sometimes I get confused. Am I noting sound, or am I noting hearing? Because like in the example that you did, Vipassana out loud, you used like pressure, vibration, which for me is the object. But then you also used seeing, which is the experience,
yes.
instead of saying like form, color, or something
yes,
like that.
Yes, yes.
So for me, it feels awkward to go back and forth between the experience and the object in how I'm noting.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I prefer to just choose one. Either do the experience or the object.
Uh-huh.
Does this make sense?
I understand what you're saying. And, you know, for me, again, there's another piece of this, so you're kind of heading into another part of the way the mind works, that the mind can either pay attention to the experience of something, and we can pay attention to the object as well. For some reason, in my mind, within the body, it naturally attends to objects. So it attends to pressure. It notices the vibration. So I'm noting the kind of quality, the kind of qualities of that. It's very used to paying attention to objects in the body. In seeing and hearing, it's more used to knowing the experience. So it just naturally is doing that shift. If for you it's easier to be with the sound and know the qualities, the pitch and tone, or the form and color, that's fine. Okay. You don't have to go back and forth. You might just kind of notice one of the other pieces to notice around it is when the mind does switch from one to the other. And in the body, you could just notice knowing vibration, knowing pressure. It's helpful to know what you are knowing, because at least in the early stages of meditation, you know, just sitting down and just sitting down for, you know, if you haven't sat down for a few minutes, you know, if you're just sitting down, the awareness is going to be aware of something. And so to acknowledge what it is that awareness is aware of. So yeah, it's fine to just pick one, but at the same time, see if it might be that the mind will naturally move back and forth, and can you just notice which it's doing?
Okay. Actually, from my experiences, it doesn't like to move back and forth. Uh-huh. Or, I mean, I can feel it when it's shifted, and then I kind of feel like, oh, I'm shifted now, the perspective or the vantage point or something like this. And
so there's a little reactivity to that.
Yes. I wish it wouldn't.
You know, part of this is that what we're doing with mindfulness practice is learning to wake up to how the mind does its thing. And so partly it does its thing by rapidly moving back and forth. So we can kind of with attention put it on one thing or another, either put it on the object or put it on the knowing. But as the mindfulness gets more, gets stronger, we begin to see, you know, that movement and the reactivity.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
So as far as concentration goes, when you're meditating, it's on the breath, but then when you get up, leave the center, and you're just out in the world, and there's not really one thing to concentrate on. Is it concentrating on whatever you're doing in the moment?
So here's another piece around mindfulness. A different kind of concentration comes with continuity of mindfulness. So the continuity of mindfulness that I was describing through using the noting practice brings a concentration. It's a concentration on changing experience. So it's more of a stability of awareness than it is a stability of object. So in the what we typically call concentration practices, where we bring our attention to a single object, the mind gets really, really quiet. And the experience tends to get pretty still. in the moment-to-moment concentration, the experience doesn't get still. The mind gets still. The mind can be, and it's the equanimity, I think, that makes that feeling of stillness, because the mind is not pulled to anything in particular. So the concentration that we can use in daily life is around this continuity of mindfulness. So just kind of continuing to notice the kind of unfolding flow of experience will bring that sense of balance. It's not easy. It's not easy. Yeah, in the back.
So I understand the whole thing about, you know, focusing on your breathing and kind of stilling the mind. And I don't know, in my situation, I've been kind of going to like AA meetings and working on like the step four, which is letting go of resentments. And I've been trying to use meditation to kind of let go of my resentments.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like I'm pretty good at, you know, focusing on my breath or just this present time and stilling the mind. But then I kind of purposely force myself to think back into the past to kind of like start letting go of those resentments or kind of become mindful of those past moments. Is there anything that you would advise in doing and doing such a thing? Like,
so this is part of your practice right now, to actually recall resentments to see, can you begin to let them go?
Right.
And that is definitely a practice that we can do. It's not what we would call pure mindfulness practice, because you're kind of bringing something in.
Okay.
But what I'd suggest is that you, in bringing something into your mind, so perhaps visualizing a situation. You know, you bring that situation back into your mind. Take, I don't know, 2 minutes to recall that situation. And then let go of that recollection process and come into your experience here and now. Because essentially often what happens is when we recreate an experience like that, the power of the mind is such that it not only recreates that that image, it also seems to impact our emotions, our body. It kind of recreates the whole experience. And so the letting go can then happen in the present moment. So you recalling a situation, then let go of the active recall in favor of just coming into, how does it feel in the body and mind? How has that memory impacted you? And then you may feel some tightness, some tension, some anger, some frustration, some holding. Just attend to those things. See if you can let go of the mind going back to the situation in favor of just being with it here and now. As you can just be mindful of it here and now, it will do its thing. And then if it completely passes, you could bring it up again and see what happens. But I'd encourage you to see if you could let go of the going back over and over again after a minute or two, because that will give you what that will do is begin to cultivate that strength of mindfulness on those feelings of resentment. And it will take time. It's a long process, but yeah, it definitely can help. Thank you. Any other? Yeah, over here. Wait, why don't you pass this one back? You have to push the button on the side.
Is the word thinking too broad a way to refer to noting the thoughts?
It is not, although at times if you find particular patterns of thought, you know, so in noting thinking, you may begin to recognize that one of the first things you might begin to recognize is that thoughts are mostly in the past or thoughts are mostly in the future. You might begin to kind of distinguish those as categories. And it can be helpful to, especially when patterns are particularly predominant for you, if you notice, for instance, that you spend a lot of time remembering, replaying old arguments. You could use something more specific for that to help, to kind of help highlight that that pattern is happening. You know, that so there's some kind of standard ones that I've mentioned. I think I mentioned in the meditation. There's planning, remembering, as kind of past and future. There's a fantasizing. There's judging. Name some more.
Worrying.
Anybody else have favorites? Name some more. These are more specific, yeah.
Obsessing.
So these are a little more specific. And then if you even have one that's kind of really predominant, very, very strong, it can often help to come up with a kind of a lighthearted note for it. And this can take a little creativity. I'm not sure I can come up with much on the top of my head. But I can tell you one. Here's one. I found myself in a pattern of praise and blame. So there was a lot of praising and a lot of blaming going on. And I noticed that there was a correlation between the two. And I initially was more focused on the blaming side, you know, the self-judgment, the self-criticism, and noting those. But then I realized that the praising was actually the setup for the judging, for the self-criticism. And so I realized I really needed to take care with noticing the praising. And so I created a little kind of, I used a tone of voice. I used to live in Texas, so I created a little southern accent for myself. She's doing that praising thing again. So that's how, just creating a little bit of humor there helped me to take it a little more lightly. So, you know, you can be creative with that part of it. But I wouldn't spend a lot of time in the moment trying to come up with what is the right word for this. If you wake up and thinking is happening and thinking it seems to be the word that pops into your mind to name that experience, just use thinking. So, and likewise also for emotions. Emotions are another place where, well, it can be very helpful to come up with a vocabulary for emotions so that we begin to get familiar, to recognize what our emotions are. So it can help to take some time with that, to do some reflection, to, I've created emotion lists to help me learn names of emotions and begin to connect them with my experience. So taking some time to do that. But then in the moment of meditation, I wouldn't spend time thinking, well, is this irritation or is this annoyance or is this actual anger? That's too much. Just whatever seems clear in the moment. Don't use a lot of thinking around the noting. Yes, and if you notice that, then note thinking. Analyzing is another one. That's one I've used a lot, analyzing. Analyzing is one. Any other questions? Yeah.
It's nice to see you.
Likewise, it's been a while.
Today, I realized as you were talking that this is a total 180-degree change for me in the way I've lived up until, a few years ago. I think I was always gradually changing, but I read a lot, I learn a lot, and I judge a lot. And it's just holy. I first started, I thought this is dumbing me down because I can't analyze or I want to be in the present moment, and I find myself doing all the things, analyzing, judging, planning, all of those things. So it just seems when I stop doing that.
I can relate to this comment. Do you want to say some more?
No, that's just that, yeah, it's such a deep change.
It's a very deep change. And, you know, I still deal with this at times, you know, that my mind has such an analytical tendency that I find it analyzing a lot. And in concentration practice, which is one of the practices I'm doing now, I have to let that go. You know, in mindfulness practice, I note analyzing. concentration practice, it's like, okay, let go of that and come back to the breath. And there is a kind of a sense of it feeling really stupid. You know, it feels like, well, this is, you know. But on the other hand, the other thing that I've begun to become very trusting about is the fact that the being in the present moment begins to open the mind and open our senses to so much more that we wouldn't connect with if we were so busy in our minds thinking about what we were experiencing and seeing. So it's a different kind of intelligence in a way, this taking in of information through the senses and just knowing what's happening in the mind. We are really, really practiced at analyzing, judging. We've been doing that a lot, worrying. We've done that a lot in our lives up to this point. And it's gotten us a long way. You know, we have done quite well, you know, many of us through these practices. You know, it's like, that's proof that it's good, right? I've done really well with analyzing, you know. So it kind of takes a little bit of a leap of faith to let go of our, like you say, it's a 180 degree shift. It's to let go of our the traditional ways that we have navigated the world in favor of just meeting experience. It's a real shift for us. But it essentially begins to open up kind of a whole new avenue of an intelligence that is not verbal. And beginning to trust that. It's like where this, Gil sometimes used this analogy of being like a really sensitive radio antenna. It's like the body is like this really sensitive device that takes in information. And we cut out a lot of it through our views, our beliefs, our ideas. We cut out a lot of it because we're thinking. You know, it can get a little overwhelming to be open to that full range of experience. So, you know, learning how to be balanced around that openness. We need to learn how to become balanced around that, just the onslaught. It can just feel like an onslaught of information. And if it's too much, then learning how to back off. Okay, you know, it's too much to be in the whole range of everything hitting me. So maybe I just need to come down to just the breath right now, just for a little while. So learning how to navigate the radar, the antenna, to tune the frequency now and then so that it's, you know, not open to the whole range, but just one frequency for a little while. But it's a huge source of information that we've been missing. And in the kind of meeting of that information, there's certain ways that the mind begins to put things together. I mean, the analytical processes don't really stop, but they begin to, we begin to see that they actually happen very naturally. So patterns, for instance, when we look at a particular pattern, if we have a particular pattern around judging, we watch that pattern. Watch the pattern come up over and over again. And we get different information about that pattern as we observe it. So it's kind of like looking at it from all different sides, seeing it happen over and over again. So there's this, the actual witnessing of the pattern brings, through this more open lens, brings in a bunch more information around the pattern that we didn't have access to. And we begin to see that the mind actually begins to put pieces together. So for myself, in watching patterns around self-hatred, around anger, you know, beginning to see how these things come into being, you know, beginning to see the whole show arising. And begin. So one of the pieces, the analysis that starts to happen almost by itself is understanding cause and effect. So the mind, through seeing experience, naturally begins to understand cause and effect. And seeing cause and effect at a very deep level, particularly around suffering, which is the framework that the Buddha was interested in, you know, suffering and the end of suffering. So seeing cause and effect around suffering begins to reveal to our minds the contribution our minds make to that pattern. And when the mind sees that, we don't have to try to analyze our way out of the pattern. It begins to just see not helpful. It begins to understand it at a very deep level that it's not helpful, as opposed to the thoughts. I mean, we can tell ourselves over and over again, this pattern is not helpful. We can recognize the drawbacks of a particular pattern of judgment. We can see that it creates unskillful speech. We can see that it creates a pattern of a contraction in our body that's unpleasant. We can see all that stuff through our thoughts and try to tell ourselves, well, that's not helpful. And yet, 2 minutes later, we're judging again. And so the power of the mind to cut through delusion is limited. The power of the thinking mind to cut through delusion is limited. Opening up to experience and seeing moment by moment how that judgment is created, the mind begins to understand from the bottom up how it's put together, and it can then start to let go. So, you know, it's just a whole new set of things that we are taking in. And for me, that's a help. You know, it's like I'm kind of really scientifically oriented, you know, very strong analytical tendencies and very rational mind. And so for me, the doorway into just this openness of experience is like, okay, this is data gathering. This is time. It's time to gather the data right now. And, you know, leave the analysis for later. And what I find when I'm just willing to be in that data gathering mode is that the understanding actually arises very organically. And I don't actually have to do much of the analysis. And that's the way a lot of my suffering has gone away.
Is that a promise?
It's a promise. Actually, it is a promise. If you can meet your experience, it takes time. I'm not saying it doesn't take time. I'm going to bring in another analogy here because this also, for me, has been a really helpful analogy. You know, the waking up and the seeing these patterns fall apart, sometimes they happen. You know, sometimes it happens in a blinding flash, and that's what we think of as insight, right? Oh, blinding flash, oh, I'll never cling again, you know. Happy for the rest of my life, you know, that's what we think of as insight. And I've had a few of those kinds of experiences, very few, where it's been very clear in the moment. And I've talked about them, you know, many of them, I've talked about them, you know, seeing a thought arise, seeing that the mind inclining towards anger and seeing, don't have to do that, and watching the whole tendency to that anger fall apart. Those kinds of things happen rarely. The vast majority of my practice is just being with whatever's happening, that data gathering mode, that just being with witnessing over and over again anger or self-hatred or you know, just being willing over and over again to meet these patterns as they arise. So the analogy that I like around this is the Buddha talks about, did I talk about that? I've talked about this recently. Maybe I talked about it last week. The Buddha talks about the mindfulness practice kind of working the way things would rot on a beach in a shipwreck. You've not heard this? Okay. So, you know, there's the shipwreck, and there's the rope and the boards of the ship, and they're all sitting on the beach. And over months, the sun, the sand, the wind wear away at those parts of the ship. And day by day, hour by hour, you don't see much change. You don't see much shifting going on in this process. But 6 months later, you know, to follow along with the analogy of the shipwreck, 6 months later, if you go out there and try to pick up the rope, you may find it just falls apart in your hand. And that is the way a lot of my practice has unfolded, through that very slow, almost imperceptible change, moment by moment. I can look back, you know, and this is one of the things the Dalai Lama says, look back over 5-10 years of your practice. Can you see a difference? It's pretty clear to me there's a huge difference. It hasn't all come about through blinding insights, you know. It's just through meeting over and over again, experience, just meeting it. There's another piece I wanted to bring in. So actually, one of the things, you know, and one of my stories that I tell often around this kind of practice or this kind of slow wearing away of something is that sometimes things can fall away without our actually being aware that when they have fallen away. We become aware that they've fallen away after the fact because we see something arising now that 3 months ago we would have reacted to and that we're no longer reacting to it. So this, for me, around a pattern of anger, observing anger over and over again, a particular pattern of anger with a particular person. Mostly I was like noticing the anger and putting it aside, noticing the anger and putting it aside because I found that trying to bring direct mindfulness to that anger put me back into the pattern of the anger. So I was like, put it aside, just put it aside, put it aside. But it was without aversion, just noticing that pattern of anger and putting my attention in my feet. So, oh, there's anger. Okay, feet. Feet, feet, feet. And I began noticing that pattern arising less and less often, the pattern of anger. And then one day, realizing the person that I was angry with came into my mind, and the anger didn't. And I actually could not construct the anger, could not even construct it anymore. And I didn't see it disappear. I'd been spending months, you know, okay, anger, put it aside, anger, put it aside. I'd been spending months doing that, so it disappeared in that kind of rotting rope way, you know. I couldn't even pick up that rope anymore. It was gone. So, yes, it's a promise, and you need patience. And we need to stop. So I'll continue with this. There was a whole other section I didn't get to on equanimity, so I'll continue with this next week.